Hey folks, Jeremy here. Before this episode kicks off, just a quick word of warning, the audio quality here is not amazing. That's because Diamond and I recorded this very improvisationally at BitSummit, finding whatever spaces we could in order to record. It wasn't an ideal setup, but the two of us wanted to record our thoughts where they were still fresh, and share our perspectives on retro games and retro game-facing titles that we saw at BitSummit this year. This week in Retronauts, we have seen the future, and it looks really old. Everyone, welcome to a very special and very noisy episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I am live and alive at BitSummit 2023. It's a post-mortem episode, and I'm here with...
Hello, everybody. This is Diamond Fight, and I'd like to remind you that both Jeremy and I are here in Japan's ancient capital, which means we are both Heianchio aliens.
Thank you. That has been your public service announcement for the day. That is correct. We are here in Kyoto, and the BitSummit for the year is complete, and we saw a lot of games that look very old, but they are not. They are new. There might have been a few old games in there. I don't know.
I saw quite a few games that were remasters of old games, spiritual successors to old games, games made by people who just said, you know what, I like that old game. I'm going to make it myself. And God bless those people, because we need more of them.
I agree. So this episode is just us sitting on the street outside of BitSummit, because they kicked us out and wouldn't let us use the meeting rooms as a studio now that the show is over. But you can enjoy the authentic sounds of people walking around and talking, strange cars driving by, and of course, cicadas. So yes. Many cicadas. The cicadas are here to help drive home how incredibly hot it is here and how much the two of us are sweating as we sit in the shade at the end of the day talking about video games.
I guess. I mean, we're really thankful. It is late in the afternoon, so we do... The sun has gone down quite a bit. The shadows are long. So we have some relief.
That's true.
It's certainly not 2 p.m. anymore, but wow. Today was a scorcher.
It was, and I'm glad that BitSummit takes place inside, because I could not enjoy video games in this kind of weather. But inside the air-conditioned, dark, cool hall, it was good times.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I saw a lot of things that just I immediately grasped. I immediately grasped what the creators had in mind.
Mm.
Like, you know, people talk all the time about games that influence them. And sometimes they're kind of circumspect about it. They kind of dance around it, especially here where, in Japan, where I think the culture is not to pull people who are not part of your group or aren't part of the conversation into the conversation.
Mm.
So I think there's just a bit of respect. It's not like people saying, oh, I don't want to talk about my influences. It's more like, oh, well, you know, the people who influence me may not know about this, and I don't want them to feel like I'm ripping them off or, you know, drawing attention to them in an unwanted way.
Sure.
But you can still look at these games and be like, oh, this person really liked Undertale, or this person really liked every British UK microcomputer game ever made.
Yeah. I heard the words Chips Challenge at BitSummit today.
Did you?
Spoken aloud. So I know.
Was it?
Hopefully somewhere Stu was big grin on his face.
Was it spoken in English or Japanese?
No, in English. The guy was just saying, oh yeah. He rattled off a bunch of influences and he said the words Chips Challenge. Like, oh, I know one person who will enjoy that.
Yes. I think there's more than one person, actually, but yes.
I know one person for sure.
Okay, there you go. Yes, absolutely. It's a shame Stuart wasn't here, but he's in Prague instead drinking beer where it's probably not as hot.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of jealous because he's probably looking at all those Mission Impossible filming locations.
Right.
You know, he's got embassies, he's got restaurants.
That aquarium restaurant doesn't really exist. And it's not because they blew it up. This is a total sidebar, but Mission Impossible came out, the first Mission Impossible, the movie, came out a few weeks after I came back from my first international trip ever, which was to Prague.
Wow.
And so I was like, whoa, I know all these places. And wow, I've been in that square where that restaurant is located, and that giant aquarium restaurant did not exist. I would have remembered that. That place is nothing like you see in the movie, but everything else was accurate.
You know, I had a similar experience with The Dark Knight, because that they have a whole sequence in Hong Kong.
Okay.
And 2008 was the first year I ever went to Hong Kong.
Okay.
So I went to see that movie, and all of a sudden Batman's in Hong Kong. I was like, hey, I've been to Hong Kong. Hey, I was on that pedestrian bridge. But of course, I can't use expert opinions, but at least
sure.
I was super excited to see Batman go where I went, and I just felt that much closer to Batman. And what
who
more,
doesn't want
what,
to feel that
yeah,
closer to?
What else can we ask for in life?
Actually, we just rewatched the last Mission Impossible movie, Fallout, in preparation for the new one. And, you know, we saw that back when it first came out, but we just got back from London, my wife and I.
Oh.
And a big part of the movie takes place in London.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We were like, oh, there's that. We were just there. Oh, is that the Tate Modern? Yep, that's the Tate Modern, et cetera, et cetera. It's always fun. That's one of my favorite things about being a world traveler is like, when you see places you've been, you have suddenly this you know, element of recognition and an understanding of what's happening that you would be lacking otherwise.
It can be a curse, though, let's be honest.
Can
sometimes
be.
If you know a place and you've seen it before, or if you've lived there, and then you watch a movie or, say, play a video game, you can immediately react to it. I can tell you, I saw a game here, one of the games we saw today, not today, but at the show, was a game called Scene Investigators.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very interesting kind of a murder mystery game in that you're in an apartment and you need to deduce several things. You need to figure out straight up who died. Usually these things are like, here's a scene of a murder, figure out how it happened. No. This was like literally who's been in this apartment, who's someone's cousin, who sat at this table, who died. You think the police would have that information on hand, but no. They need you to answer all these questions.
Of course, because you're a scene investigator.
As I invested, you know, as I go around the apartment, I'm picking up birthday cards, I'm picking up someone's wallet, I'm looking at their ID. I picked up an envelope with an address, and it's, you know, it says the Bronx, New York, and it had a zip code.
Oh.
And I looked, and I was like, I talked to the representative, not developer, but a representative speaking English. I was like, hey, do you mind if I'm a pedant? He's like, go right ahead. It's like, that is not a Bronx zip code.
At least you were fair about it. Do you mind if I be a pedant? So I respect that.
Little things like that can, you know, jab you in the side.
Yeah, for sure.
But maybe today I saved some future person who's playing Scene Investigators. They'll play it someday in the future and they'll, oh, there's the Bronx and there's a correct Bronx zip code. And now I can enjoy the rest of this video game.
Yeah. No, it's like, you know, having lived in San Francisco for a decade, when I watch Bullet, I'm like, this chase does not make geographical sense. It's cool, but they certainly sacrificed, like, an actual sense of moving through the city.
And what's with all these green beetles all over the place?
Exactly. Anyway, none of this has anything to do with the games we saw at BitSummit that have a retro tinge to them, and that's really what we're here to talk about. So, I'm not going to ask you what your game of the show was, because I would have to make a choice for game of the show, and I can't do that. So, instead, let me just ask, what's the first thing that comes to mind when I say, what'd you see?
Well,
which game?
I would probably start with the Sunsoft booth. That was one of the first places I visited. Unfortunately, while they had a standee for the recently announced Clock Tower remaster, I really hoped they would have the game. They had no Clockmaster.
So right.
Clockmaster. They had no Clock Tower for me to enjoy.
That's a shame.
They did have
anime Jennifer Connelly, though.
Yeah. And they also had Hebureke 2.
Yeah, so that's a gimmick in the U.S., or is that Euphoria?
I think it's a separate series, because it's like, Hebureke, I think, is a Super Nintendo or Super Famicom game that spawned a bunch of other...
No, the original was on Famicom.
It was on Famicom.
Yeah.
Oh, Famicom. Okay.
That one was Euphoria, now that I think about it. Yeah.
But it spawned this whole series of puzzle platformers, all with different subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no Hebureke 2. as far as I can tell.
Yep.
Until today. And, you know, they haven't made a Heburekka game in like 2 decades. But somehow they're, now's the time they're going to make 2. And I was just instantly captivated, you know?
Yeah, all right. So we are continuing this podcast in a different setting due to equipment failure and street noise and heat. So now there's cafe noise instead. You're just getting the full live Retronauts experience. Please enjoy. Anyway, so Heburekka 2.
Yeah, which is, you know, part of this long-running and yet also long-dormant puzzle platformer series. And it's funny, even though there's been so many Heburekka games over the years, now just 2. They've gone to number 2, they've counted to 2, and I'll just say, aesthetically, it's really lovely. I really, you know, I think it had a sort of Yoshi's Woolly World, you know, Kirby's Epic Yarn kind of feel. I think the characters were a little more cartoony, like they stood out, but the backgrounds and, you know, solid, the quote-unquote solid elements in the levels.
Yeah, they didn't go all in the way that Goodfeels games do.
Mm.
And that's okay. Like, that's fine. It has a distinct look. They had a cool little felt and cotton ball diorama in the actual booth, which was great to see. It was like, you know, one of those diorama Famicom game covers come to life. But what is Heburekka? For those who do not know, which is probably most Americans because it never came to the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I barely know what Heburekka is. I'm sure I played one of the earlier games, you know, back in the emulation days, because it's a kind of a weird name that stands out, especially if you look at it in Hiragana, because He and Be are basically the same character, but with a little notation on it, so it just looks funny in Japanese, and it just sounds funny when you say it out loud. And I don't know if it might even mean something funny. I'll be honest, my Japanese is not up to snuff here, but in my heart, I want to say maybe it means something about like getting drunk, but I don't. That could be fan fiction. That could be Japanese fan fiction. But at least in Heburekka 2, you're this little guy, and you pick up things and you throw them at little enemies, and I got into a boss battle where the boss could pick up my thing and throw it back at me. So we were engaged in, you know, a deadly game of one-upsmanship. Maybe.
That has a very Wario Land boss feel to it. There's, you know, like the basketball rabbit.
Or maybe Link's Awakening. You know, Link's Awakening had those bosses that would sort of throw things at you and you throw it back at them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was just kind of a really cute, very charming, don't know where it's going, don't know what's going to happen with it, but the fact that Heburekka 2 exists at all was just kind of one of those, you know, puts a smile on your face, you know?
I agree.
Heburekka 2.
And I noticed that Sunsoft is also still all in on Shanghai.
Yeah.
Which, that has an interesting history, because they didn't create Shanghai. It was an American named Brody Lockard who created it for Activision, I want to say. And I believe Sunsoft licensed it in Japan for arcades, and they just kind of ran with it. Like, it's just been a thing in their library. And sometimes, you know, like a Shanghai game will show up on Arcade Archives on Switch or PS4. But, yeah, it's just, you know, making matches with Mahjong tiles.
Well, yeah, but that's the funny thing. Because, you know, to most Americans, if you say Mahjong, they're probably going to think of Shanghai because it's a game based around Mahjong tiles. But, of course, here in Japan, Mahjong is a game you play with the Mahjong tiles. So you can't release a game here called Mahjong, otherwise we will think you're talking about the other game.
Right.
So in that way, Shanghai is kind of the perfect cover. You know, it's like, oh, this isn't, you know, what do you mean Mahjong? It's Shanghai. You match tiles.
Yeah, but they're still making those. It's called Shanghai Legend is the new one. And I like that they have this big display of giant Mahjong tiles piled up.
Oh, they look so good, yeah.
Big plastic tiles.
I mean, I wanted to eat them. I couldn't explain this.
Please don't.
They look delicious.
They kind of, I mean, if they looked like anything food-wise, it was fondant, and do not eat.
Is it cake? No, it's Shanghai.
Oh, no.
But no, I had fun with that one, too, because I don't know if this is groundbreaking or not, but the version they were showing actually has co-op play. So I was there early on the first day, so it was just me and the staff, basically. But a very nice lady as part of the staff joined the game with me, and we were both, you know, matching tiles and taking them away. And, you know, we ran into dead end, as you do. But I couldn't help but think, oh, this is fun. It's a fun way to share time with people. And, yeah, you know, as she put it to me, it's like, oh, this way you can play with someone who's not very good at the game, which was a funny thing to say to me, because, like, I don't know how you can be bad at Shanghai. I mean, you can be better at it, but yeah, how bad can you be at matching tiles?
Well, you have to understand the strategy for Shanghai.
Okay. Like,
there are certain moves you want to make and certain moves that you should not make. Mm. And the way, you know, like, every tile arrangement has different choke points.
Mm.
So anytime you have a bunch of, like, a really long line of tiles, you run the risk, because you can only match tiles on the edge of a stack.
Yeah.
Like, of a tier of the stack. And you run the risk of getting to a point where you have tiles in a long line, and they're nested in a way that you can't make matches. The tiles you need are all in there, but they're blocked off by one another.
Mm.
Like, the match for one tile is, or tile set, is blocked off by a match for a different tile set. And you have to learn to kind of see those and avoid those and strategize to, like, not just make the most obvious matches. So yes, you can actually be bad at Shanghai. Like, just refusing to learn how that works. So, I can sort of see what she's saying. It's like the Super Mario Galaxy.
It is funny, though. You mentioned the layouts. That was a good point, because the game gave you a wide choice of layouts.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I picked one that looked just like a Space Invader.
Okay.
Which is not a Sunset property, but...
It's not?
Yeah. But I guess those shapes don't belong to anybody. So...
They belong to Taito.
I mean, the exact shapes, but you know what I mean. They had an Invader-like shape.
Reference. Okay, got it.
And I called it an Invader shape, and the lady laughed. So they know. Sunset knows.
Anyway, yeah, it's a real interesting mix of games at the Sunsoft booth, and game concepts in the case of Clock Tower, which is not actually at the booth. Yeah, it's cool to see them back. I mentioned this in the previous attempt at recording that got cut off, but Sunsoft is under new management, and their current president is just someone who's determined to... He sees the value in Sunsoft's properties.
Hmm.
Like, you know, a lot of games that people associate with Sunsoft are things like Batman.
Yes.
But they're not all licensed, and he recognizes that, you know, things like Iki and Shanghai and Clock Tower and Iberike and Gimmick all have value, and that there's, you know, people who remember them fondly, and also the core properties, the core concepts are strong enough that they can create a new generation of fans. So it's great to see.
Well, they seem to have done very well with the Blaster Master Zero series, which Integrates made. And actually, I just played the first Blaster Master Zero just recently this summer on a whim, and had a good time with that.
It's really well made, yeah.
But speaking of Integrates...
Oh, I didn't get to play their games because you have to have a ticket, and I was like, I'm not standing in this line.
That's too bad. Well... Let me tell you, Integrates showed up this year, and they had two games.
And I only saw the one.
Nope, they had two. It was interesting because they're both, you know, Integrates games.
Yeah.
But they're all very different. One of them, I believe, had already been announced a few months ago. It was a licensed property. It was Blaze in the Deep Blue.
Yeah.
Blaze in the Deep Blue. Again, also complicating matters is that both these games have totally different titles in Japanese and English. So the giant signs are one thing, but if you look up online, they're a different thing. But Blaze in the Deep Blue is some sort of licensed property, and that's very much more of a traditional Metroidvania-style thing.
It seemed very Metroidvania. Yeah. But it seemed like also your powers were other people.
Yeah, like your only attack seemed to be summoning like a giant creature that did like one big strike.
Right, but also there was... So you run around as a girl.
Mm.
And one of her attacks was to take another girl and cause her to spin like a disc and like roll that at enemies and cause them to explode.
Yeah, there was also
there was also
a character switching mechanic, which I don't think I got to use it, but there was definitely on the controllers, it was like switch characters, which reminded me of the released earlier this year, the
Grim Guardians.
Is it okay? There's Grim Guardians and there's Gal Guardians, and I keep forgetting which was the first title and which was the second title because they changed the name out of some sort of copyright conflict.
Oh right, yeah, yeah.
Whatever it's called, I had fun with that game too, and that was also very much a swap characters game. But yeah, this was, you know, obviously with the name, it seems like you're underwater a lot, or at least you're in like a cave that's very wet. And I fought one of those big, what do you call them, like lanternfishes, with the big dangly thing in front. And had some pretty straightforward attack patterns, and it was very much about, oh, just hit it a lot and don't get hit by its, you know, blasts, and occasionally it would suck a giant rock into its mouth. And then mash the rock up, which hurt it, but also spit rocks at you. So it was kind of a weird match of attrition.
Okay. Yeah, but in terms of like style, it's very much the Indie Creates, you know. Wow, I just totally blanked on the series. The blue Azure Striker Gunvolt. That's
yes,
it.
Gunvolt. The Gunvolt
Azure
series.
Azure is blue, so yes. I'm correct there. Yeah, it's got that kind of visual style, lush animation, great pixel art.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the other one?
The other one, which I believe the English title is Umbral Strike or Umbral Claw.
That is not a good title in English.
It's very straight. I mean, the Japanese one I think is more of a play on words, but they're going for something a little more basic in English. And what I thought was very interesting...
Is that really basic? Oh, yes,
I mean,
Umbral.
It's better than Japanese, you know? But... What I thought was really interesting about that game is you're playing a cat.
Okay.
Possibly the spirit of a cat, but you're definitely a cat. And as a cat, you're basically defenseless. You have like a dodge move, but you can't really hurt anything. So you could survive by dodging, but if you don't survive by dodging, well, you die.
Okay.
But then, big anime explosion, lots of kanji on the screen, because... Cats have 9 lives.
Of course.
So the gimmick of this game is if you die, you use up one of your lives, and the game very much counts these down in a very animated style. And every time you die, you come back and you're stronger.
Hmm.
So you have no offense. You only have dodging. When you come back a little bit, you have like a sort of projectile. It's not very strong. It has a cooldown. But you can throw a projectile. You come back again, you've got a claw attack. You come back again, you've got, you know, I think a double jump. And it's a one-hit kill situation, by the way. So it's not,
okay.
You know, you don't really have a lot of, you know, leeway to make errors. So even though it was a very short demo, I ended up losing a bunch of lives. And then I became, like, a sort of... Catman, like anthropomorphic sort of badass. Like all of a sudden I was running and jumping and like slashing. So, you know, the enemies suddenly became trivial. At least most enemies. So I think that's a really interesting way to build a game. You know, it reminds me of the recent, what they call the reverse Metroidvania. I want to say it's Unleashed, Uninvited. I'm sorry, the name escapes right now, but it's on PC, it's definitely on Switch. The gimmick of that game was it's a Metroidvania, but as you fight the bosses, all the other enemies and bosses grow a little bit stronger.
Hmm.
So they get powers, but you don't. And in this Umbral Claw game, you start with nothing, and if you lose one of your limited lives, you get stronger. But of course, if you lose too many lives, the game's going to end.
Got it.
And there also seem to be story implications for that, because you as a cat, you were living with the memories of, you know, your owner, you know, a little girl who you loved and you love the girl and the girl loved you.
Joan Arbuckle.
Yeah. And I got the feeling that the more you die, the less you can recall the girl. Like, you start losing memories, but you gain strength. So, I get just all around the board, really interesting game. And of course, because Zynga creates, looks great, plays great. Even when you're a powerless cat, it's kind of like, what's going on here? I want to see more of this. So, you know, the licensed anime game, I'm sure that's going to be a lot of fun to play. I'm sure that's going to work out. Hopefully it's not too horny. You know, Indie Creates, I'm sorry. Sometimes they're a little too horny for their own good. But at least the cat game, I don't think it's going to be horny. I can only pray it is not horny for cats.
Well, I mean, if you turn into a cat man, then it's probably going to be minimally horny. If you turn into a cat girl, all bets were off the table.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the internet now. I mean, the internet is just cat girl fever, you know?
And you know, God bless him. So, going to like the least horny thing imaginable, there was a game called Last Command.
Oh,
that caught my eye. I don't know if you got to check it out.
I did. I played that one.
So there's a little card that they hand out when you walk by, and they say, "Snake Cross Bullet Hell."
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's really true. It's not like a Danmaku, you know, Battle Garaga type game. It's actually very heavily inspired by Undertale. It's black and white.
Mm.
You know, white on black. And it basically kind of takes the concept of the RPG battles that are shooters in Undertale and says, what if that were Snake?
Mm-hmm.
So you're playing, you know, like the Nokia Snake game, and you're moving around the field, collecting objects, and your snake gets longer. And at first it doesn't seem like it's, you know, there's much going on. You, like, collect a bunch of objects, like data. You're in a computer.
Right.
And it causes you to, like, finish the stage, but after a while enemies start showing up, and these are like, you know, you're an abstract little snake blob.
Mm-hmm.
But these enemies are very well rendered and large. So like the first one is the Iron Guard Knight, and he's like a dude on a horse with a lance, and he takes up like, you know, a sixth of the screen.
Yeah, big.
And so you have to avoid him while grabbing the data points around the screen. But as you start doing that, he's shooting these lances across mm-hmm. the screen. And this is where it starts to look like Undertale, because the lances are these red projectiles that streak across the screen. So you have to use your little snake to avoid the lances, kind of maneuver between them. And as you collect the data points, you eventually build up enough to launch an attack against the knight. And he has, you know, a health meter. And every time you launch an attack, it knocks down a chunk of the health meter. But the demo, like, at the end shows a bunch of, like, previews of future bosses. And
yeah.
It gets pretty, looks pretty high intensity. But mm-hmm. it's definitely, it's a really interesting approach for Snake. Anyway, I don't want to take all the oxygen out of this conversation.
No,
What do you think?
I really liked it. I thought the colors were great. The fact that, most of the information you're seeing is black and white or shades of off-white, but then the enemies are launching these big attacks at you that are very sort of red and pink, so they stand out even more. Gives you good visual hints. I like that you have a little dash attack, so you get to, you know, it aids you in dodging, of course, but also that's how you hurt the boss, in that you have to collect the data points, which makes you stronger, and then you fire the data points at the boss's heart. And once you wound it enough, it becomes vulnerable, and then you have to dash into it and hit it. And all this is timed. It's not too tight, but, like, you have to do things and get them in and hit your thing and then move away. Because, you know, as the fight goes on, the boss gets more and more aggressive. you know, I think at first the boss just sort of sits there and maybe throws something at you. But by the end, the boss is crisscrossing on the screen and throwing lances and shooting little bullets that explode into smaller bullets. So it definitely seems that the game is going to get harder as it goes along. You know, even each counter is going to get harder and harder as it goes along. So I thought it was really cool. And as I recall, I spoke to someone at the booth there. Remember, it's a game, it's made in Taiwan. And I think it might actually be out already.
Okay.
But they were probably showing off either a new localization or maybe it's coming to a console soon. But I think there's a version that's already out there. So if you heard this game and it sounds good, look it up. I think you probably played some version of it already.
Yeah, it's called Last Command.
Last Command. Not Blast Command. Last Command. As in the end of commands.
Yes, there we go. No more commands for you. Speaking of commands and black and white, a game that caught my eye, one that you actually played, and I just looked at it and was like, wow, that's interesting, was Algolimath.
Oh, yeah.
The AI programming dungeon crawler game. It's basically, the premise strikes me as, what if you made wizardry, but you did it as Mega Man Battleship Challenge? So you have a party, and you basically program them, kind of like the Gambit system in Final Fantasy XII a little bit, but as a dungeon crawler, and you basically just, like, from what I can tell you, just let your party go into the dungeon and operate on their programming and see how far they can get. And it's almost roguelike in that sense, I think, and that you're not necessarily going to win the first time you go out there, but it's just about, you know, seeing how you can optimize your team. And I don't know, that was my impression.
Yeah.
But you can actually speak more to it because you are confident enough in your Japanese to actually play it, whereas this was just like very dense programming instructions. I didn't even want to try.
Well, the demo did have English.
Oh, did it?
It did.
I blew it.
But I spoke to the man in Japanese and about the game, and he was explaining to me that in the demo version, it was very straightforward. Just like, you program the characters, you put them in the dungeon, they go in the dungeon until they die, then they come back out, and you start again. But each fight, you defeat monsters, and when you defeat a monster, you get some kind of programming node from them.
Okay.
So when you start off, all your party has the most basic and simple of start, random attack, random target. That's
it. So it's like Final Fantasy V, when you start out as the freelancer, you've got fight and run.
Basically. But then you beat some monsters, and all of a sudden you have a heal command. So you can give that to the healer in your party. And it's like a conditional statement. You're like, if one of my allies has less than 50% health, I will heal them. If not, I will attack. So the more you progress in the game, the more nodes you get, the more options you get. Also, if you add a node to a character, even if it's not hooked up to anything, if you just put it on the character, that raises their stats. So there's always value in getting more nodes and assigning them to your characters.
So it's like junctioning magic in Final Fantasy VIII. I'm going to describe this game entirely in terms of other RPGs.
It's great.
But these are all things I like, yeah. So I'm excited.
I believe he said that in the proper game, it will be about making choices and deciding how far in the dungeon do you want to go, do you want to risk keep going, or do you want to turn around? Because when I played it, the first floor was pretty easy, just very small enemies, and my party would, you know, just attacking randomly and would just win. And I should also say, there is a fast-forward button, which is very useful because you can't do anything in the battle, so you might as well just fast-forward if you're not surprised by the outcome. But when it got to the second floor, I fought against these much larger monsters, and they, you know, they wiped me out. But when I went back and I had healing powers, I beat those monsters and I think made it one more floor, but then got worn down by another monster. But by that point, I had acquired so many more powers. Now I had healing powers. I had a mage that could buff my attacks of other characters. I think I had a guard attack. So each time I played, I was getting further and further and further. So I think it's a really interesting use. You know, I feel like AI is kind of a buzzword right now, but this is definitely, you know, this is AI for good, because you are the programmer. You are programming a computer to go through dungeons, which is like, yes, I mean, freelance dungeoners do need to make a living, but I feel like, shouldn't we have computers do the jobs we don't really want to do?
Right.
Like, if there are goblins in a dungeon out there, shouldn't we send the computers down there first before we send down someone
who's... fight the bosses.
Yeah. So, I'm real interested in Algol, even though it's kind of hard to say it, Algolmith? Algolum? I guess I think it's a. I think it's going to be a portmanteau of algorithm and golem. I believe that's what they're going for, because in my experience in Japan, they use golem for a lot of just general automaton uses, like this year's big hit Tears of the Kingdom. Mm-hmm. All those robots you meet. In English, they're called constructs. In Japanese, they're called golems.
Well, you know, it's part of the great Jewish tradition here in Japan.
Hey, there are definitely Jews in Japan. There's got to be, you know, I'm not the only one.
No, it does seem really interesting. Okay, so those are some black and white games. Let's talk about something that's extremely not black and white. I don't know if you played this, Moons of Darsalin. Darsalin? A game that looks like it really wants to be an Amiga game.
Ooh.
The creator of this game was like, let's create the most British game we can possibly imagine. And so it is a game, like, it has the Amiga aesthetic. It's so, so painfully Amiga. And it plays like a mashup of all these different British games. Exile, like, I don't know if you've ever played Exile. I just recently kind of dicked around with it for my Metroidvania Works series. And it's this, like, exploratory game when you go to another planet and just wander around and try to find your way around. It's got that kind of vibe to it. You're on another planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very kind of open. But each area is broken into a stage and has goals. And the goal, at least in the first stage in the demo, is very Lemmings-like in that you have to lead other explorers to an exit, to a base, safely. And along the way, you acquire a gun that allows you to create platforms.
Hmm.
So you have to like create branches, but and like paths and things like that that the other explorers can run along. But you have limited ammo for this gun, so you have to kind of ration it and use it wisely. At the same time, it also has like a jetpack solar jetman feel, because you do pick up a jetpack and you can fly, but it's got an overheat mechanic and limited fuel. And it's kind of Turrican-ish because you can shoot in all directions and yeah, you just have like free aim. It just feels like they said, let's Amiga it up. Let's make the most British thing ever. And it's very interesting, and it's extremely hard. And I feel like it's deliberately hard in the way that they designed the controls, because there's a jump button that's on a very, it's like an unintuitive trigger button,
oh,
shoulder trigger for jumping. But you can also use it to grab onto ledges and stuff. But then to fly the jetpack, you press up on the controller. So it's I thought the controls were pretty unintuitive, but I feel like that's deliberate. I don't know that I love it, but just the overall package is extremely, like, it's a love letter to 8 and 16-bit microcomputer games from the UK. And I feel like it's calling out to Stuart to review it. So you missed that one. It was right next to Gundog. It's like a visual novel in space, very Snatcher-ish. It's got the look of a PC-98 game, except it's using a Game Boy color palette, which is a weird mashup. But yeah, it's very like very authentic to that era of game, like the late 80s. It's, you know, got the late Showa era anime designs, and in fact, the guy I was talking to at the booth was talking about how the creators originally had one or two characters who looked more like late 90s anime characters, and fans were like, you know, everything about this is just authentic, it's perfect, it really captures the look of, you know, PC-9801 Adventures, except these two characters. So they redrew some of the characters to look more authentically, you know, just less angular. They've got softer, poofier hair, the bigger, rounder eyes, just like in that late 80s style. So, anyway, those were both kind of right next to each other in a space, and they both caught my eye because they're very much love letters, like I said, to totally different styles of games from the same sort of era.
That's cool. I'm sorry I missed out on Gundog. That sounds like it'd be very exciting.
You don't actually play as a dog.
What?
I know, right? It's some sort of riff on Gundam.
Oh,
but
okay. Yeah.
I thought it was going to be like an action game where you play a dog in a mech, and it wasn't that. But it still looks pretty good, and you know, it's sort of like, let's make a fake PC-9801 game.
Mmm. ask you, did you by chance see Shinonome?
I didn't. I saw a sign for it, but I did not stop.
Yeah, they had a very big banner, a very nice colorful banner. This is a game that caught my eye before the show, so the idea that I would play it at the show was very appealing to me. It's available in early access right now.
Okay.
And I will probably pick it up after the show because I really enjoyed the demo.
Okay.
So I feel like they definitely took some inspiration from Shirin the Wanderer, mm-hmm. in that it's roguelike, it's overhead. Mm-hmm. So you are, I'm guessing, some sort of medium, and you're exploring an old Japanese house. So very, very Kyoto already. And you walk in room to room. You have a limited inventory. You can only pick up so many things. You have a stamina counter that's going down all the time. Not too quickly, but you can't dawdle. The room, it's roguelike, so the room layouts are going to change. And the goal, as far as I can tell, is just to make it out.
Okay.
But there are going to be some yokai, there are going to be some monsters in there. And there seem to be a variety of creatures. Some of them were very small. Some of them were kind of harmless. Some just sort of chase you around. Others are very aggressive. And you can use your tools to sort of deal with them as best you can. I know I had a gun. It's a very primitive kind of flintlock kind of gun. But, of course, very limited ammunition. I had some spikes that I could drop on the floor that, of course, they don't go anywhere, but if you can lure the monsters onto them, then they take damage and maybe they die from the spikes.
Okay.
There was a candle to illuminate dark spaces. There were bags of ammo. There were food you pick up, so, you know, you can replenish your health. You can replenish your stamina. And it's just a really, you know, tense, but not too intense sort of push and pull as you're exploring the space. You're trying to find your way, but you're also got to... You've got to manage what you pick up. You've got to put things... You can put things down again. You might double back. If you light a fire, you can use that against the monsters. You know, if you think about a traditional Japanese house, they might have a big fire pit in the middle of the room.
And so, also, the entire thing is made out of bamboo. And
right.
Tatami mats.
So mm-hmm.
Very flammable.
Right. But if you have an open flame like that, and you can... You get a monster... Also, another point. The rooms are independent of each other, but the monsters can chase you from room to room. And the monsters can also hear you in other rooms. So, this being a show floor demo, I really couldn't hear the audio very well. But I know the description said, if you listen carefully, you can hear monsters in other rooms. So you can tell, even without opening a door, you can hear if someone's next to the room or not.
Kind of a Hunt the Wumpus situation.
Yeah, a little bit.
So it's like Luigi's Mansion meets Shirin the Wanderer meets Pocky and Rocky. With the Hunt the Wumpus in there.
I mean...
Am I oversimplifying here?
I feel like we should probably just say Legend of Zelda 1, because it is the rooms are very much Zelda-like.
Okay.
In that most rooms have, you know, cardinal exits. But again, once the doors are open, the doors are open. There are warps. Eventually, I found a map, and that helped a lot sort of orient myself, try and find the exit. I found a key at some point to unlock a door. But, you know, I believe I cleared it in about 12 minutes. And at the time, this was the first day, they said they were handing out towels to the first 30 people who beat the demo. And they told me I was number 4.
Nice.
And this was not early in the day, so I felt pretty proud of myself.
Did you get the towel?
I did. I got a free towel.
Congratulations.
So, you know, collusion. Sorry about that, Retronauts. But still.
It's fine. As long as we're not paying you for this.
No,
sorry,
not at all.
Bad news. You're doing this episode for free, my friend.
I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it played. I had fun with it. I feel like... I can only imagine how much more complicated it gets. There's probably going to be more, you know, more floors, bigger monsters, you know, dark spaces, maybe something with lingering effects on it. You know, I only saw a few different monsters, but they all had different abilities, different habits. There was a little, like, fire creature. Think about the candles who chase you in Super Mario Bros. 3. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't really do anything, but they pursue you nonstop. But if you lure them onto a candle or a lantern... They illuminate the room for you.
Nice.
And they stop moving because they're burning something. So
they found their purpose.
Yeah. So I just thought that was really clever. You know, because at first I tried to hit them and the fire didn't really care about my weapons. But all of a sudden I could use it and that opened up a world to me. So yeah, Shinonome. Kind of hard to remember, but very intriguing. Early access right now. Check that out.
Yeah, okay. So a game that I think we both played and probably both enjoyed was called Good Old Days.
Yes.
Which, I mean, if there was anything at the show that was targeted to Jeremy Parrish, it was Good Old Days.
Yes.
Which is very clearly a riff on the Goonies for NES and the Goonies 2. It's like, mechanically, it plays much more like Goonies 1, where you have bombs that you can drop, and there's skull doors you open up.
Yep, yep.
And, like, the story is absolutely riffing on the Goonies to the point where it might be legally actionable. I don't know. But,
well, I know the little boy.
But structurally, it's not quite Goonies 2, because it doesn't have the front back and it doesn't have the adventure scenes, but it's Goonies 1, but in a big open-ended world that's kind of puzzle-like.
I know the you know, at the opener, you play this little boy in their house, and, you know, their debt collector is there to get money, and as they, as way of intimidating them, say, oh, we captured your friends, right? All your friends, the Noogies.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, wow. They literally just took Goonies and reversed the G in the end.
Yep. And you're playing in the city that you're based in is Arostia.
Yeah.
Not Astoria.
Right.
Yeah, so they could probably find a little more subtle way to do that. But yes, the debt collector is actually a really interesting element, because even though it's an open-ended game-ish, it's timed.
Mm.
And your task is to clear, so, you know, Misadventures of Tron Bonne, you have to clear a debt.
Yeah.
So you have to collect $50,000, which, you know, that's a lot to ask of a little kid.
Yeah.
But you have to collect $50,000 and take it back to the house and give it to the debt collector by 8 p.m. that night. It starts at 10 in the morning.
Mm.
And the time doesn't seem to count down, like, real time, but it also isn't, like, super fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I would guess you probably need to complete the game in, like, 2 or 3 hours. But that does add an interesting element of tension to it. That whole, you know, kind of Wario Land-ish, how much money can you get, with a time element to it, which is something different.
Right. And dying also gives you a time penalty.
Yes.
So there's that element,
like,
too.
Knocks 5 minutes off, I think.
Yeah. Not too huge, but definitely, yeah. I'm sure it's going to add up.
It's one hit kills, yeah. Yeah, and there are a lot of traps where the first time you come across them, you're like, oh, how would I know that was there? Like, there's, you know, floors that break away.
Yeah.
And you can tell because there's a little bit of a texture, but if you don't know to look for it, it's very subtle.
Yeah.
So you're just going to fall to your death and, you know, lose 5 minutes right there.
The respawning seemed pretty generous, though. They didn't, like, put you way back and made you, like, you know, do a whole level again, but...
No. But Mikey is less... he has fewer defensive options than... defensive options than the actual Mikey. He can drop bombs and have a timer. You can actually interact with them a little bit. You can push them around.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't kick. You can't do the karate kick. So if you want to blow up a bat or a mouse or whatever, you got to time your bomb and do it carefully. So it's challenging and tricky. But you're finding that you're, like, blowing open saves that have the... you know, one-eyed Willy skull on it, and collecting either money in there or keys, and you have to use keys, silver and gold keys, to open different doors. And there's a lot of things that I, you know, encountered, and I was like, I don't know what this does. There's a phone booth.
Yeah, and that was mysterious.
Like, yeah, it says this isn't used like a normal phone booth, but it doesn't explain what it is. But then if you look at the map, the legend on the map, the subscreen, like, marks out where the locations of the phone booths are. So maybe those are, like, warp portals or something?
Possibly, yeah. I thought it was interesting. The localization was clearly a work in progress. I know when I spoke to developers, one of them was very proud. Like, oh, I speak some English. Like, okay, great. And, you know, the text in the game was... some of it was a little awkward. Some of it was kind of spot on. And I definitely got a chuckle out of the opening when the debt collector, you know, threatens the kid, and the kid just says, don't.
Yes.
He just dropped an F-bomb. I was like, oh, okay.
Oh. That's not very Richard Donner-like of you.
I also thought it was funny that the debt collector looked like one of the Blues Brothers. At first, I assumed the debt collector was also the gangsters, but no, the gangsters look totally different. So they went for original character design of those
guys.
The
boss of the gangsters looks like Ma Fratelli.
Yes.
She looks like Anne Ramsey. But then the rest are really weird.
There's, yeah,
like, a dude who kind of looks like Dr. Fred from Maniac Mansion, and he's in, like, a hovering wheelchair or something. It was really bizarre. Like, it They're a motley collection, that's for sure.
But yeah,
none of them look like Cypher from The Matrix. Yeah, anyway, I thought that looked pretty appealing. I would like to play more of it. I do love me some Goonies. And I do love me some legally distinct Goonies as well.
And someone's got to make it, right?
Yes, but please do not mention anything about jetpacks to them. I'll be so mad. I think we have time to maybe talk about two or three more.
Okay.
You mentioned Everdeep Aurora. I didn't get to play that, but
yes.
It looks really good. Very SteamWorld Dig-like.
Yes.
But with a kind of a, like the structure of it. Okay, first, it has a really great 8-bit micro look to it.
Yes.
Very limited color palette, mm-hmm. 4 colors, but not Game Boy style. It has the look of, I don't know, what system would that be? Not quite Spectrum, because it doesn't have the color clash.
Maybe? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like one of those plus situations. Like, it looks like an old computer,
yeah.
But you can tell it has too many colors on the screen at once to be an old computer, but like,
that's like VGA minus.
Resolution-wise, it looks like that, you know, and a lot of the characters are sort of single color to themselves.
Right.
And you get the...
Yeah. So it has a distinct look. And then the level structures reminded me in a lot of ways, you know, it's got the SteamWorld Dig thing where you're digging, but it kind of reminded me of Wario Land 2 and 3, where if you sometimes press against places, it's like, oh, I've just revealed this entire space. Now I can collect treasures.
Yeah, it's an interesting game that you start off and you're like evacuating something, and then you're hiding underground because of some calamity, and the goal I think is to find your mother. So you meet a lot of characters while you're exploring underground, and so it seems like there's going to be a very heavy narrative element because there really wasn't any combat that I could see.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about digging and exploring, because when you dig, you know. Thank God these people play The Simpsons. They know you can dig up. So, and left and right. So if you find yourself in trouble, you can sort of selectively dig different angles and sort of make steps for yourself. The drill has a limited amount of battery life, but there's, you know, charging stations scattered throughout the underworld. So you can, if you find a spot, you can go back there and refresh your energy. I met a lot of people who were looking for things, you know. Oh, I'm looking for a flower. I'm looking for, you know, a hat or something. So a lot of these characters were much larger than me, which I think is a good, you know, storytelling, almost like environmental storytelling. It really helps you feel like a kid when you meet these creatures that are much larger than you. They're not necessarily evil. They're just bigger. Like, they're the adults and you're a kid. So I thought that was really intriguing. I'm kind of curious how it works, because I feel like any game where you can alter the environment and potentially dig yourself into a hole, literally, like, what happens if you trap yourself in a hole? Is there, like, a reset button? Is there a, you know, were there save points that I didn't find out, you know?
No, you can, there's a frog.
Your
little frog buddy, Frobert or something like that?
I don't think I met the frog.
Yeah, I didn't get to play it myself because people were, like, crowding it.
Hmm.
There was just no space, but I watched someone, and he had the ability to call his little frog buddy, and the frog would warp him back up to the surface.
Oh.
To the last campfire that he visited.
Okay.
So that seems to be how it happens. Again, it's very SteamWorld Dig-like. SteamWorld Dig, when you get stuck, you can warp back to the surface, and you can dig in all directions, and it's much more focused around digging than combat, you're collecting things, but it has a feel all its own, for sure.
Yeah. I can't help but wonder if there might be some Spelunky there, too. I know Spelunky did pretty well here. And, you know, especially the idea of digging into a cavern and opening up a much larger space. I don't know if it's roguelike. I didn't talk to the developers about that aspect of it, so I don't know how much of it is scripted and how much of it is, you know, open to interpretation, but it seemed like the kind of game you could definitely get lost in.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, in a good way, not, like, in an angry way.
Right. Like getting lost in someone's eyes.
Oh, very romantic.
Wasn't it? Yeah. That's a bit summer for you. Let's see. There's the two more games I want to talk about. Akura and Castle in the Darkness 2. Is there anything else you want to mention?
One second. Okay. Yeah. I got one more. There was a game I picked out before the show even started. You know, I'm a simple person. I look up the games before the show starts, and usually there's one game that catches my eye, like, oh, that's the best name game of the show. And this year, that name was Death the Guitar.
Ah, yes, I saw that.
And it's a really interesting platformer. I want to call it a masochist platformer, but maybe that's because I suck at it.
No, that's another one I didn't get to play, but I watched people playing it. And I gave up on the prospect of playing it because they just kept dying, doing the same thing over and over and over and over again, and they just would not give up.
Mm.
But they also wouldn't get any better, so I was like, all right, I can't play this.
But really fun premise, you are a guitar. You're a guitar out for revenge. And your only weapon is music. But your music is fatal. So you can run your little guitar can run around, you can jump, and you can strum, which creates a sort of mini area effect and, you know, will basically kill anything that's near you. But as you run around and jump and, you know, kill these other creatures, I don't know what you're killing, something.
It's like other people playing music.
Yeah.
There's like a DJ
right.
who launches missiles at you, and there's just like dudes running around in hoodies and listening to headphones
right.
who like shoot lasers at you.
But like everyone looks a little weird, so I don't know if I don't know if these are supposed to be humans or, you know, elves or something. But, you know, the basics, you know, the game sort of ramps up very slowly in that, you know, lets you run around things. If you strum your guitar next to an amp, it will launch you into a certain direction. You can bounce on certain things. You can launch yourself through glass and break the glass. If you strum on certain surfaces, it will sort of resonate through the surface and kill anything on the surface. You can send charges into like chords and then move platforms around the levels. And what happens pretty soon is the bad guys pick up guns. And when the enemies have guns, they do not hesitate. They are shoot first, ask questions, never types. So you gotta move really fast. You gotta strum, you gotta dash around. I mean, the good news is your character can move very quickly.
Yes.
So you definitely have the advantage in a lot of situations, but the enemies shoot fast. They don't miss unless you are also very fast. Those DJ things are infuriating because they launch homing missiles.
Yep.
Like six at a time.
Yep.
And if you can kill the DJ, but that doesn't stop the missiles, or at least the set that they like.
Right.
They won't launch anymore, but if they've already launched them, you have to now just run away and hope that you don't. And of course, everything's one hit kill. So if you die, you start the room over, and the game certainly knows where its bread is buttered in that it gives you a score that tells you how long it takes to beat this level and how many times you died.
Right.
And then it ranks you. So I do think they are going for a Super Meat Boy kind of thing with that aspect of it. Maybe even a Celeste, although it doesn't really play a Celeste, but still.
Yeah.
It knows you're going to die a lot. So it's not just me, but I do feel like I was much worse of the game than I would have liked, because I was really excited about the name. It's definitely cool. No regrets. I'm certainly intrigued about to try it again, maybe. But yeah, certainly one of those challenging action platformers, not a leisurely, you know, guitar killing platformer.
Yeah. So speaking of masochist and difficult platformers, one last game to talk about that we played is Castle in the Darkness 2.
Ooh.
And, this wasn't actually on the show floor, but we got a private demo, and if you like Castle in the Darkness, you'll like this one.
Yeah.
I feel like this one is basically super inspired by East 3.
Mm.
Like, I just recently played East 3, and, like, immediately I looked at the cave with the tiers of wooden platforms and the enemies you're attacking and the speed with which you attack, and it just seems very East 3 like. And also, it's extremely hard. The bosses can kill you in like 5 seconds, just like East 3.
I My first takeaway was I was impressed by how much more agile the hero is now. Like, a lot of things have changed since the first game. I would say your default movement speed is basically a healthy jog. You can, you know, you've got your slash has a decent range. You can jump and slash. You can level up now by killing enemies, so there's that, you get that advantage of it. You mentioned ease. To me, my first thought was Order of Ecclesia, in that early on, the initial monsters you fight, even though they're very small monsters, they take a couple hits, so you're kind of like, oh man, I guess I'm really, really weak. But within a few minutes, I was already dealing much more damage to them because I leveled up, and so I started feeling stronger right away. And they're also
very Easter-y.
And there also was kind of a world map thing going on.
Oh, okay.
That reminded me of Order of Ecclesia, and that, you know, you had even though it's definitely a Metroidvania sensation, like you'll see ledges you can't reach, you'll see platforms you can't, you know, quite get to. So definitely there'll be some backtracking. And the developer told me that you will definitely be revisiting areas again later on, and everything is interconnected. There is still a world map where you'll leave an area and you'll go to a map screen and then go to the next area. So not the levels are not as tiny as Order of Ecclesia, but definitely there's some hints there.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, anyway, that seems good. I am looking forward to playing it.
Yeah, very excited.
It will actually hit consoles, which is nice. So yeah, I think that one's still a ways away.
Oh yeah.
Like I was very fortunate to have the developer show me, you know, like bits and pieces of the game throughout, because the second boss is unbelievably brutal. Did you fight the second boss, the bat?
Like the kind of gargoyle thing?
Yeah. The one that moves just like Slagra from Castlevania? Like the animation.
Yeah.
Like, what do I know that from? And yeah, it's Slagra.
Yeah, I would say the game is very interesting aesthetically in that it looks a lot closer to 16-bit at first, but then some monsters, like that boss, have a lot more animation to them. And like when you first see the boss, it kind of turns its head around and looks at you, and I audibly sort of was shocked. I was like, "Ooh!" Like that was just, it was a lot of animation. It wasn't just a simple sort of, you know, frame swap, right, you know. But the gargoyle boss was quite challenging. But I must say, it wasn't challenging in the sense that, oh geez, this is going to be impossible. I just felt like in a demo setting, I've seen enough.
Yeah.
But like each time I was fighting it, I was definitely dealing damage to it. I got a little better each time. I was struggling a little bit with the hitboxes, but the developer showed me, you know, a little some moves, and you know, because he makes the game, of course, he handled them a little better. But it showed me that I had the right idea. Sometimes I just wasn't quite hitting it in the right spot. Like if you don't quite hit its head directly, and maybe you just hit its wing, you're not going to score a hit.
Okay.
So it looks like you're just missing. And I thought, oh, is it invincible? No, I wasn't hitting the right spot. So, obviously, the game is very much a work in progress, so they're going to be fine-tuning this stuff, you know,
right,
for months, if not years. But looks great, felt great, I think really exciting, you know, to revisit Castle Darkness after so long. My personal favorite thing is that there's a map now. There's definitely a map. That was my number one complaint last time, is that there was no map. This one definitely has a map. And it's dynamic, and it shows where you are and shows nearby save points, so that's going to be a real boon to you know, searching around and finding things. He told me that even though I got to that, what was basically the end of that first level, he said, you missed a lot of secrets. It's like, okay, I missed a lot of secrets. He wasn't taunting me. I think he just he legit wanted me to know that I had more to find. Mm-hmm.
And finally, on the show floor, Diamond had a brief on-the-spot interview with Jörg Tittle, whose bona fides should speak for themselves in the following interview segment.
Hi everybody, Diamond Fight here, At the recent Bit Summit Indie Game Festival in Kyoto, Japan, I ran into a celebrity in the bathroom. I don't know that he considered himself a celebrity, so he was very surprised when I said, "Excuse me, aren't you Jorg Tittle?" To which he immediately answered, "What's your name?" Anyway, call it a meet cute, call it a accidental happenstance, but I was very excited to meet Jorg Tittle because of my enthusiasm for Illbleed. You may have heard me discuss Illbleed on the podcast before. I wrote about it for This Week in Retro, but it's a 2001 survival horror game that's unlike anything else. And one reason it's unlike anything else is that it features Jorg Tittle playing a character named Jorg, modeled after himself. Why is this? Why would a Japanese video game add the likeness and name of a relative stranger from another country? This is exactly why I had to speak to Jorg Tittle about his unique place in video game history. Also, given the nature of Illbleed, I figured any opportunity to talk to anyone involved in the production of that game was worth talking to. In my opinion, Jorg's story, while brief, did not disappoint. I hope you forgive the background noise. We were in the middle of the show floor, and you can hear music from Jorg's C-Smash VSR, a VR squash game based on Cosmic Smash for the Dreamcast. Jorg showed me a signed copy of said Dreamcast game. He was very excited to have a signature on his copy. I hope you enjoy the interview. Speaking here to Jorg Tittle in Bit Summit in front of a C-Smash VRS demo, a VR version of Cosmic Smash from the Dreamcast. And we were just talking about Illbleed. So if you could please tell me the story about how you ended up in Illbleed as a guy named Jorg.
Hello.
Yes.
So I, back in 1998, 99 or something like that, I don't remember exactly, was writing for the official Dreamcast magazine in the U.S. And there was a trailer, teaser for a game called Illbleed that had been leaked on the internet, and it had the famous words in it: "You will shit with fear.
Yes.
You'll vomit with excitement.
Right.
Oh, you'll shit with fear. That's what it was. It was something like that.
I'm pretty sure shit with fear.
You'll vomit excitement. You're puke with pleasure.
Yes, we got it.
Very classy introduction to it. It was, and I was just intrigued by the madness of it, and I got in touch with the creator, who was so flattered that I had made contact with him from the U.S. And his name was Nishigaki, Shinya Nishigaki.
Yes.
And he was a lovely man.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I would love to do an article about Illbleed for the official Dreamcast magazine. And I convinced my editor-in-chief, Simon Cox, who's a dear friend of mine now, to let me write an article about it, which then turned out to be a cover feature. A 6-page article, I think it was, and with beautiful art, and we turned the whole sort of article into this, B-movie sort of thing. It was really gorgeous.
Yes.
And it got the attention of a publisher in the U.S., and he managed to get a publishing deal in the U.S.
Because
the game had been dropped by Sega in Japan as well. It was supposed to be published by Sega, but it wasn't in the end. So,
because that was another game that came out 2001 when the Dreamcast was already...
That's right. And so he was very grateful for that. And he came over to New York, and we went to like random steakhouses. Nishigaki-san, before he sadly passed away, he actually opened his own steak restaurant as well in Japan.
Wow.
He was a massive steak aficionado.
Okay.
So with him, I discovered places like Smith and Volensky and other things that I would never afford if I, because I was a student, essentially.
Yeah.
And he was so grateful. At some point, he said, like, he surprised me. He just said, like, I we have put a character in your name called York S. Baker. I'm like, why Baker? Because you're like a detective, because you found us, and then you also found us a publisher, and it's Baker Street. So that was the logic behind that, which was lovely. And then I saw my face, and it was literally my face in the game.
Yeah.
And he says, like, this is creepy and weird. And so I'm maybe the first ever, like, avatar human in a game. I mean, maybe Nishigaki-san even invented the metaverse, for God's sake. But there I was in Illbleed, a game that I had difficulty even playing. It was so random.
It is a very strange game to play.
I have no idea how to play it. I still, to this day, I'm a terrible Illbleed player. But the atmosphere is fascinating. The acting, of course, is absolutely awful. I'm partly responsible for that because I was on the cast, and it was the weirdest recording session. It was in San Diego. Lanny Minella was directing the voiceover sessions, and she was doing like 20 different voices for it, including all of the boys and things. It was weird, but it was very nice. But it was at a time when I guess games weren't supposed to have actors for each individual role, and some people would just like do everything.
Yeah, there was that transition period where you had some games would cast everybody for everything, and other games where it's like they'd have one person who they met in an office somewhere. It's like, oh, you speak English here. You can play three characters, right?
Yes. I remember the African American character in the game being played by a white dude, and I was very uncomfortable about that in the meeting sessions. Like, can't you find a black actor? Especially his performance was so bad. He's just like, all right, bro, here I am, the big black character. And you're like, what the hell is this even allowed? Whatever. So there's a lot of weirdness. But that's how I came to Illbleed. That's how Illbleed came into my life. And I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it passionately. And I loved Nishigaki-san very, very, very passionately. He was just a fucking great guy. And the fact that he just suddenly disappeared.
Yeah.
Is one of the great tragedies, really, because he was a visionary. I mean, he was like Sweary and a bunch of other Japanese creators, weird and incongruous, and sometimes not necessarily commercially sound, but he had ideas that to this day we gradually start trickling into games. And he just didn't quite pull them together in a way that made sense to people unless they knew how to connect those dots.
Yeah.
But those ideas were fucking precious. And I understand why that game has such a long tail and such a slow long tail.
Yeah.
And people finding it and realizing, wow, this was a work of art.
Absolutely. I mean, and while there's definitely some influences have come around again, like, there really is nothing else like Illbleed. You just can't. No one else is making a game out there where you're hunting for traps with a VR headset, but there's monsters, but you're inside an amusement park, but maybe you're gonna die for real. And the chapter you're in particular is also one of the weirdest chapters in the whole game, which is saying something. Like, it's behind the scenes of the deadly amusement park, but it's also like a game.
Yes. But he also knew that I wanted to be an actor. So, because I was studying at NYU, I was studying acting, so he thought that was fascinating. And that's why he wanted to give me my break within this Hollywood thing. Like, inspired story, and I'm like, it's okay. But, I don't know. It was such a unique thing because we barely communicated with each other in the same language.
Right.
But we had the soul connection. It was so good to hang out with a man. I miss him.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Are you from New York then?
No, I'm from, I was born in Belgium.
Okay.
And I'm half German, half Polish, born in Brussels. Yeah, and I studied at NYU, and that's where we met. And yes, and so, I was in New York at the time. And then I moved to Los Angeles, and then I moved to London, and I'm in London.
Okay. I was kind of curious, because so you wrote about Illbleed, and you had this sort of preview. So what state was it it in versus how it ended up, finally? Because I know they changed some things around, and obviously they added a character with you, so, like, do you know how much...
It changed a lot. When I wrote the preview, I'd only seen videos.
Oh, okay.
And I had conversations with Ishigaki-san, and he was essentially still making shit up as he went.
Yeah.
And and I loved that. I was like, wow. It's like, to me, it felt like he was making jazz.
Yeah.
You know, he was riffing.
Mm-hmm.
And I could totally, because I have a pretty good bullshit detector, I could see that he was coming up with stuff as he was telling me about the game. He was coming up with ideas as he was telling me about it. And, then he would drift off and clearly make mental notes. For like, yeah, I sure should do that. And then he would come back to me and was like, I love this. Like, because I'd witnessed a lot of games that were always the same goddamn thing, it's always the same mechanics or whatever, and he was just riffing. And yeah, so it's one massive improvisation in a way. Yeah, he was a great dude.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing your story about that and about Nishigaki, who, you know, the more I read about it, the more I wish I could have, met him, talked to him. And I know, he would have loved an event like this where everyone is out here just doing whatever they can, you know?
Yeah.
I know there was a tribute yesterday to Kenji Ino, who passed away 10 years ago, but I feel like Nishigaki would be in the same camp, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. They are in the same camp. They're the sort of, not forgotten, because we haven't forgotten about them, but they definitely have more light shone on them, and so the more people like yourself do it, the better, because he belongs in the history, gaming history, in a major way.
I agree. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, man.
That wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it, despite the noise. As always, Retronauts is about 90% supported by fans, listeners, and community through Patreon. To keep this show going and to get cool stuff in return, check out patreon.com/retronauts and subscribe to us for a few bucks a month, which will give you access to every Monday's episode a week in advance without advertisements or promotions. Or you can up the ante and subscribe to the exclusive content level. $5 a month gets you not only early access to our Monday episodes, but patron-exclusive episodes every other Friday, as well as weekly columns and mini-podcasts by Diamond Fight, Discord access, and other goodies. As for us, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet, here doing Retronauts, at limitedrungames.com, doing stuff like making maps for Castlevania games, and on my YouTube channel, called Jeremy Parrish. I'm also on social media, but that's a disaster these days, so let's not talk about that. And you can find Diamond online at Retronauts, and also on social media under the name Fight Club, FEITCLUB. We'll be back next week with another episode, unless you're a patron, in which case we'll be back in a few days with another episode. We'll be right back.